Hi, it's Tom here. Last Orders is about to start in just one moment. We've got a fantastic episode for you today with the great Dominic Frisby of 17 million fuck-offs fame. If that makes no sense to you, it will in just one minute. We're also mixing things up a bit on the show from here on out, not sticking so strictly to nanny state or public health topics, so that we can talk about freedom and killjoyism more broadly, as well as anything else that sufficiently winds Chris up month to month. So do let us know what you think. But before we get going, I just want to tell you briefly about how best you can support Last Orders and you can support Spiked in general. All of our podcasts and articles are free. We want to keep it that way. But to do that, we rely on the generosity of you good people through donations. In particular, regular monthly donations help us enormously, allowing us to plan ahead for bigger and better things. Even £5 each month can be a huge help. So if you like our work, if you like the podcast and you want to support us, please do consider becoming a regular donor. Just go to spiked-online.com and click the big red donate button in the top right corner. That's spiked-online.com and the big red button. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the podcast that's for freedom and against killjoys. My name's Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden, along with an invited guest, discuss the latest news with a focus on illiberal liberals, censors, and nanny statists. In this episode, we're joined by the writer and comedian Dominic Frisby to discuss the centenary of Prohibition, the untold history of tax, the bizarre case of the Bristol Pound, and the fake news about fake news. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. We're back, first episode of 2020. I hope all of our listeners had a suitably gluttonous and drunken Christmas and New Year. With me this month, as he is every month, is the IEA's Director of Lifestyle Economics, Chris Snowden. Chris, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing very well, thanks, and Happy New Year to you and everybody listening.
And joining us today, we have the writer, comedian and author, Dominic Frisby. Dominic, thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure, thank you very much for having me.
So we're going to talk about a lot today. We're going to talk about 100 years since Prohibition in the US. We're going to talk about Dominic's excellent new book, which is a look at history through the lens of tax. And we're going to talk about the supposed scourge of fake news during the election campaign, among a couple of other things. But first, I want to talk about your single, Dom. 17 million fuck-offs, which has kind of become, if not the official, certainly the unofficial kind of anthem of Brexit and the Brexit moment. There's a big campaign at the moment trying to get it to number one for Brexit Day on the 31st. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the song and where people can pick it up and support it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's called 17 million fuck-offs, and it's basically a song about how Brexit was a great big up yours from the British people towards the establishment. Judging by the number of emails I get and the amount of people who've watched it on YouTube and Facebook and everywhere else, people find it very amusing. I've used an old English folk song. And it's basically a, well, maybe play a bit. Would you want to play a tiny bit in the podcast?
Yeah, let's do it right now.
17 million fuck-offs. They wheeled in the experts to tell us what's right. They gave us the benefit of their foresight. To leave is calamitous, that's definite. Food shortages, no medicine, planes grounded, a house price crash, 500,000 jobs lost, cost of £4,300 to every home, stock market collapse, riots, no sandwiches, there'd be an outbreak of super gonorrhea. They seriously said that. Donald Tusk at the EU said it'd be the end of Western civilization as we know it. I'm not joking. And one more thing, if you vote to leave, that makes you racist. The British told them to fuck off. 17 million fuck offs. A general election was fun.
Okay, and hopefully you found that quite amusing. Anyway, there's a big campaign at the moment to get it to number one for January the 31st. I think it would be very amusing that Radio 1 is forced to play that song. And the way to make that happen is to buy the single. Now, you can, because one single counts for 1,000 streams, which is quite interesting. So even if you play it and play it and play it, it's just better, more effective to buy the single. You can buy the single at Amazon or on iTunes, and it costs 79 or 99p. And any profit the song makes, I've already said I'm going to give it to the Maggie Oliver Foundation. Maggie Oliver's the lady who's set up the foundation to help the victims of the child abuse, the grooming gangs. So any proceeds will help them. And yeah, you know, that's one cause, but the bigger cause is comedy. And that's perhaps the greatest cause of all. Not that I'm doing cause rankings. And yeah, if we buy the single, we get it to number one. National merriment.
There you go. Well, all listeners, go out there, make sure you buy it. Don't just stream it. And let's all support that. So to start off, let's talk about a slightly less jovial topic, and that's prohibition. So it's been 100 years since the US began its 13-year experiment with prohibition on alcohol. I think it's fair to say it wreaked havoc on US society and to some degree has haunted it ever since. So we just want to talk a bit about this pretty remarkable experiment in authoritarianism, what happened as a result of it, what we might learn from it, how we're probably definitely not learning anything from it the way we're going about things now. Chris, you touched on this in a long read for Spiked a couple of weeks ago. Do you want to talk a little bit about how prohibition came about in the first place, I guess, and what that kind of really represented?
It's a very, very long story, which I wrote a book about, actually, called The Art of Suppression, available on Amazon.
So many plugs today.
The Art of Suppression, Pleasure, Panic, and Prohibition since 1800. The first couple of chapters are about US alcohol prohibition. It's a very long story how it came about. It was a kind of a 100-year campaign, largely from what you might now call the religious right, although it was more like the religious left, really. It was a progressive. It was a, really the cornerstone of the progressive movement. It's probably the greatest achievement in a lot of respects. And like a lot of progressive ideas, it was based on the idea that the government is mighty and you can just make a pure society and create a new man through the force of law and coercion. And there were various sort of happy accidents from the prohibitionist point of view in the years before the 18th Amendment was passed. The First World War helped a lot because most of the brewers were Germans and the prohibitionists were ruthless in exploiting that and literally portraying the brewers as spies and the enemy within. And
unbelievably kind of smeared, weren't they?
Yeah, they were very, it was a very effective campaign.
They were accused of sending off their profits, the profits of their beer sales, and redistributing, they were paying for the German war effort was one of the things.
Of course, there was no truth in this, so far as we know, whatsoever. So, yeah, it just built up over a long period of time. The First World War pushed it over the edge for that reason, but also because it was seen to be necessary to restrict the alcohol industry for the war effort. So, you know, we don't want to be wasting our land growing crops for alcohol when we should be growing it for bread and so on. And then, of course, it all fell apart. What lessons have we learned? What should we learn from it? I think people did learn the lesson initially. In fact, for decades afterwards, the temperance movement was nowhere, really, for the rest of the 20th century. It had a real job in kind of pulling itself back to any kind of relevance at all. And prohibition was a byword for overreaching government and kind of utopian idiocy. However, and this is what I wrote about a bit in my Spike piece, you now and again, you do get people taking the sort of contrarian view that actually prohibition worked. David Aronovich did this a few months ago in the Times. And their argument is, although it's completely wrong, really, and it tends to gloss over the worst aspects of prohibition, is interesting insofar as it focuses entirely on what we would now describe as, you know, the public health effects. So the aim of prohibition, as far as the revision is concerned, was to reduce per capita alcohol consumption. And of course it did that. It would be amazing if it hadn't done that to some extent. It came nowhere close to eliminating it. It was only about a third lower than it had been before prohibition by the time prohibition ended. And it's true that it did stay relatively low, kind of historically low for the rest of the 20th century. On the other hand, Britain saw exactly the same thing happen without prohibition coming in. You know, alcohol consumption fell massively in the first 20 years of the 20th century and it stayed very low until, well, it's never really recovered.
Till I came of age.
It gradually started increasing from the 1960s. And if you look at it purely through that lens, you can say, yeah, it was a success. But you have to be completely blinkered to take that approach, because obviously the real problem with prohibition wasn't that it didn't reduce drinking at all. It was that it created all this havoc and basically created organized crime, and also created the agencies that fight organized crime, which is probably just as bad. You know, it was really the birth of the FBI and the modern American penal state. And I could go on about all the other problems, which to any sensible person clearly outweigh what few benefits there may have been in terms of, you know, maybe some people were prevented from drinking themselves to death. I wouldn't deny that, but it wasn't worth it for all the unintended consequences. And that is what we forget today in public health, the unintended consequences, the black market, you know, these real problems, which we're now going to see in America because of the clampdown on vaping, which Australia is already seeing on really quite an epic scale in terms of its tobacco black market, which it didn't have really 10 years ago. And now it's enormous, not with prohibition, but with sort of neo-prohibitionist policies like plain packaging and very high taxes.
And it didn't stop alcohol consumption, as you say, even though it made it illegal. It didn't stop people drinking, which was the ultimate goal of the movement. It just drove drinking underground, and a bit like drugs laws today, made drinking a much more dangerous thing than it needed to be. So alcoholics were put in prison rather than get the healthcare they needed. The alcohol they were consuming was much more dangerous. So there was much more alcohol poisoning. There was much more alcohol related crime. And so, you know, you list out your unintended consequences, there is one of them.
There were many. And the other point to make, I think, is that in a way, you shouldn't be arguing about whether it worked or not. However you define worked, that shouldn't be the argument. The problem with prohibition fundamentally was it was deeply, deeply illiberal. It trampled on what I consider to be a pretty important human right, which is the right to drink alcohol, or more broadly, the right to do with your body what you choose. That argument is almost never made, possibly because, you know, if you're an anti-prohibitionist like me, you don't really need to. You can just point to all the unintended consequences and the deaths and the methanol poisonings and all the rest of it. But we shouldn't forget the key issue really is it was an issue of liberty, just as it is with e-cigarettes and smoking and drinking today. It's fundamentally an issue of liberty. Even if it works, even if the US had a sufficiently large police state to enforce it, it still would have been immoral.
It was interesting as well, because you were talking about how so much of this came out of kind of progressive reformers, and how a lot of the people who were actually at the forefront of women's suffrage in the US, which followed quite closely after prohibition, as I remember it, were at the forefront of pushing for all of this. And it's interesting that in some of the reaction around the anniversary, you also see alleged kind of a liberals, if you like, coming out of the woodwork and saying, maybe prohibition wasn't
right,
so bad.
Like Aronovich, yeah.
There was a piece in The Guardian, which I think you linked to, Chris, by Moira Donegan, who I think was kind of implicated in some New York City Me Too scandal. She was one of the people drew up this list of quote shitty media men, so it's interesting crossovers, but basically saying that the whole point of prohibition was that men were really abusive because they drank so much, and that this was a feminist crusade and maybe there's things we could learn from it. I mean, it seems really quite strange that even as you say, but
was right in a way. I mean, a lot of what she said was correct. The movement started principally because of women. Well, you know, it was a women's march in the 1870s, and they were sick with good reason of their husbands going off to the saloon and spending all the money. You can understand it. Does that mean we should have prohibition now on feminist grounds? I would argue probably not.
How it came about, I think there's lots of quite pertinent messages for today and how it came about. And his biggest champion was a chap called Wayne Wheeler, who we've mentioned on this podcast before, who was stabbed in the thigh by a drunk farmer as a young boy. And it gave him a sort of lifelong loathing of alcohol. And he coined the term pressure politics, and he devoted his whole life to getting prohibition, you know, made statute. And he was just the most brilliant, brilliant campaigner, utterly ruthless. And his one issue was prohibition, almost in a funny kind of way, like Farage over Brexit. You're either with us or you're against it. And he forged these weird alliances. One was the women's suffrage movement, all sorts of women's lib champions, but he also allied with the Ku Klux Klan, were supporters of his, but also Jewish and Italian and I don't even know what you call them, black anti-drinking groups were all part of his allies. So these kind of morally opposed on other issues. And if there had ever been a referendum in the US on prohibition could never have won. But because, you know, more people were in favor of the laws remaining as they were, but because of Wheeler's pressure politics, and, you know, he'd bring adversaries, people who opposed him, he'd just take them down, he'd smear them, and he'd champion those who supported his cause. So in order to make sure that Wheeler was on their side, politicians started arguing for prohibition. But the biggest barrier of all to getting prohibition made legal was the fact that so much US tax revenue at the time derived from alcohol taxes. At the time, there was no income tax in America. Income tax only became into America in 1913. So there was no chance of prohibition ever being made law unless somehow the government could
find some more
replace
money
that
else.
Lost yeah. revenue. And so Wayne Wheeler became one of the biggest champions of getting income tax made statute in America. And it was then, once income tax
pretty much made, history's greatest monster, isn't he? Really?
Yeah. I mean, unbelievable. And because once income tax was made statute, then he could get prohibition in. And then again, one of the big arguments for its repeal, there's been these documents that have been discovered, these old surveys by politicians of public opinion in the Hoover-Roosevelt election of, would it be 1930?
32.
32, that election when Roosevelt abandoned it. But it was found that the biggest issue at the time was not, as history records it now, Roosevelt's New Deal. It was the fact that Roosevelt was going to abandon prohibition. Mm. That was what won him. And Hoover stood against, he wanted prohibition to continue. By this point, Wheeler was dead. So there wasn't that same guy championing it. But one of Roosevelt's biggest arguments for justifying the repeal of prohibition was that he was going to tax beer, and beer was going to pay, the taxes on alcohol were going to pay for his New Deal. So there's a huge tax story, both in the institution and the repeal of prohibition.
And then, of course, they repealed income tax because they wouldn't need it anymore, right?
Yeah, of course they did.
So, Chris, just before we move on, it was fascinating kind of reading what you'd written about it as well as other people, how similar the kind of arguments and the campaigns for prohibition were then and how similar to the kind of prohibition campaigns we see today in relation to other things.
Groups like Action on Smoking Health, Alcohol Focus Scotland, you know, all the groups we have today, very much in the mould of the Anti-Saloon League. You know, the Anti-Saloon League, as Dominic says, you know, they invented that kind of model of centralised, you know, you don't need grassroots per se. You do your lobbying on Capitol Hill, you use the press, you use the media, you use advertising very cleverly. And the advertising that the Anti-Saloon League used is well worth Googling. I mean, it's an amazing
change doing it today.
Adverts. You know, Think of the Children, big part of it, which of course we still get. Now, huge emphasis on the industry, which you obviously get from all these pressure groups today. You know, we're not fighting drinkers, we're fighting the liquor trust and all this kind of stuff. So there's so many parallels. It's fascinating.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So next up, let's talk about Dominic's excellent book, Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future. Now, Dominic, you're a libertarian, so you're always obsessed with tax, I imagine. But this book is really fascinating. It's this kind of romp through history, through this lens of tax, I think everyone can get a lot out of. But to kick things off, I guess, what's the meat of your thesis in this? You know, why is tax so important, you think, to how things develop?
The meat of my thesis is that once you start looking at the world today and the world and at history and at the future, you, through this lens of taxation, ultimately a book about tax sounds boring, but I promise you it isn't. And once you start looking at the world through this prism, you realize that, you know, tax is power. If as soon as a leader, whether it's a king or an emperor or a government, once they lose control of the tax base, they lose their power. And tax is also destiny, that you shape a society the way you tax it. And tax is a form of control. People use taxes to guide behavior. And there's all these different ways that tax. So one of the things I used to do when I did it, this thing started as an Edinburgh show, is I used to get people to shout out famous events from history, and I would endeavor to tell them the untold tax story without which that event would have been very different. And so, for example, every single war, everyone was paid for by taxes, either during or after the event. You turn around and say, well, wars are funded by debt. Well, debt is a taxation on the future. And, you know, the aim of every single conquest in history was to take control of the tax base. You plunder and then you tax. You take control of the land, the labor, the produce, and the profit. Every single rebellion and revolt in history has been some kind of upraising against some kind of perceived injustice perpetrated by the tax system. Most famous, you know, the American Revolution, no taxation without representation, the French Revolution, the hundreds of petty taxes. The Philippine Revolution began with the cry of Pugad Lawin exhorting citizens to tear up their tax certificates. And if you think today, you know, if we wanted to bring down the government, the one way to do it is not to pay your taxes. You know, if we don't want the BBC to exist in its current form, don't pay your, what my libertarian friend John Matonis calls your TV tax. But, you know, don't pay it. And unfortunately, it's very difficult not to pay your taxes in the world we live in today, because all taxes are, well, most taxes are deducted at source. But yeah, so taxes control its power. You know, in the birth of Christ, for example, Mary and Joseph were in Bethlehem for a census, which is, you know, levied for the purposes of collecting taxes. The first men on the moon, you know, NASA was a tax-funded operation. You know, even things like building the Great Wall of China. People think the Great Wall of China was built to keep out the Mongol hordes, and it was. But it was also built to collect duties coming in and out of the Chinese Empire. Hadrian's Wall had the same purpose in Scotland. You know,
English Civil War, I'm trying to think of it.
The English Civil War was a war over tax. Who controlled taxes, Parliament or the Crown? And, you know, it started with the row over ship money, over Charles I's ship money.
The Russian Revolution,
you know, there were kind of two. Yeah. But the first one was injudicious taxes levied against the Tsar. And the second one was just tax was control. The ultimate form of taxation is slavery, because you own nothing. You don't own any of your own labor. And serfdom, which was kind of where the Russians were at that point, was sort of halfway. The Russian one is a bit more hazy, but if you sort of dig around and you manipulate language a little bit,
you can find
there's a tax. If you buy the thing that taxes rule and taxes control, yeah, if you buy that theory, then it was a rejection of that form of control.
So this will be coming out on the week of Brexit Day, and one section of your book that I thought was very fascinating and quite relevant in that respect was the Peasants' Revolt. We're actually recording this in Aldgate, which is just down the road from where the Essex rebels entered London during that revolt. So do you want to tell us a bit about that? What's the story of that?
Well, the Peasants' Revolt is like the best story ever. And if I ever get commissioned by Netflix to write a mini-series, it's going to be about the Peasants' Revolt. But it was, we have this idea, it's sort of perpetrated as these thick peasants, you know, revolting. And it's sort of almost a clownish affair, but it was brilliantly, brilliantly orchestrated, where it goes all the way back to the Black Death, effectively. And there's a tax story in the Black Death as well. Suddenly, as a result of the Black Death wiping out whatever it was, 60% of the workforce, something like that, serfs suddenly found the value of their labor was greatly increased. And by the way, just as a side note, roughly 50% of your everything you ever earn in your lifetime is taken from you in taxes. Roughly, by the time you include debt and inflation, which is a stealth tax, taxation without legislation. And so you own 50% of your labor, and the other 50% of your labor is given to the government. It's the same as the serf's working week. 3 days were given to his lord and 3 days he could till the land himself. So admittedly, life's slightly better for the workers of today than it was for the medieval serf. But on a time basis, we are as owned now as they were then. But anyway, the sudden value of a serf's labor as a result of the Black Death increased. And so suddenly a lot of lords, in order to keep the service of their serfs, started paying them and giving them their freedom. And serfs were handling slaves, the peasants, they were handling money for the very first time. And so we got as a result of that, we got the introduction of poll taxes. And it's as a result of poll taxes, of course, that we have surnames. Yeah. Prior to poll taxes, we didn't need surnames. The names you have because of tax. And Richard II was crowned, but he was a mine, and John of Gaunt was the richest man in the country, and he was waging all sorts of wars on the continent, the Hundred Years' War. And he levied the first poll tax, and he raised a certain amount of money, and this was, I think, 1380, and then he raised a second poll tax, and that didn't raise quite as much money, and he raised a third poll tax, and he sent in his men to collect the poll taxes, and the peasants refused to pay, and they killed some of the tax collectors. If only you could do the same thing today. Now, the intellectual champion of the Peasants' Revolt was a sort of Bernie Sanders figure by the name of John Ball, and he made all these great speeches, and he talked about this terrible inequality, and he said there shall always be injustice until everything is owned in the commons. And everywhere he went, he was such a thorn in the side of the church that he was a priest, but he kept getting excommunicated. He was excommunicated numerous times. So he couldn't preach in churches. So he preached in the hills and the fields. And his biggest villain was the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was, of course, the church was a great tax collector at the time. And eventually they threw him in Maidstone prison. And he said, I shall be freed by 20,000 men. And it was like, no, no, you won't. Anyway, this rebellion started in a little village in Essex, but it was coordinated with rebels in Kent. And within days of these tax collectors in Essex being killed, 20,000 men led by a chap called Walter the Tiler, who was a tiler of roofs and a low person. We know him today as Wat Tyler, freed John Ball from Rochester prison, and they marched on London. And everywhere they went, their policy was to burn all tax documents, and they would go in the, all lawyers were killed and all legal documents were burnt, and they went in the prisons, and everyone who was in prison for non-payment of taxes was freed. And it was a, there was a deliberate targeting of the tax system. And so all the tax records were burnt, and eventually they made their way to London. And it was timed brilliantly because John of Gaunt was up in Scotland fighting at the time. So there was hardly any army in London at the time. And they basically took London. Shall I finish this? I mean, I was just the sort of great tribute of what a brilliant.
Yeah, and you'll have to buy the book if you want to find out.
If you want to find out how it ended and how Wat Tyler was stabbed in the back by the mayor of London.
Chris, to sort of, you know, shoehorn in some of your interests in particular in relation to this, the question of sin taxes is something that we talk about quite a lot. I was just wondering, like, when is that something that really starts to come in, not necessarily just in this country, but in general? You know, at what point did trying to basically tax people out of, you know, their bad habits, when did that become so popular?
Well, largely when the government realised that it could get away with it, not just get away with it, but be patted on the back by quite a lot of vocal special interest groups. I think Nigel Lawson said in the 80s that putting up fuel duty and cigarette duty were about the only taxes he would be thanked for raising. And of course, there have been instances where they've gone too far, and it hasn't quite created a peasant's revolt, but there've been, you know, significant unrest. The fuel protests of, when was that, 2000?
Yeah.
That was a big deal. And they froze fuel duty for 10 years after
sort
that.
Sort of proto-gilets jaunes.
The government froze
Yeah, they were the English gilets jaunes, weren't they? Yeah.
And to a much lesser extent, the pasty tax issue, which kind of came out of absolutely nowhere, you know, and was pretty trivial when it comes down to it.
Not in Cornwall. It's
there are loads of examples of sin taxes from history. And the golden rule of taxation is don't try and raise new taxes in times of peace. You need some kind of national emergency.
Right.
It's always a national emergency when income tax, you know, quantitative easing. There's always some kind of emergency. But there's some good tax. Peter the Great's beard tax, Henry VIII had a beard tax as well. Peter the Great decided that he wanted Russians to be more like Western Europeans. And if they were going to be like Western Europeans, they would have to shave off their beards.
What was Henry VIII's logic for it?
Henry VIII, presumably he didn't pay the beard tax himself. But Peter the Great decided beards were unfashionable and he wanted to stop Russians having beards. So in order to stop them, he taxed beards. And to prove you'd paid the tax, if you wanted to have a beard, to prove you'd paid the tax, you would have to hang a token from your beard that said on one side tax paid and on the other side the beard is a superfluous burden. So that's an example.
That is,
and there was
quite stigmatizing.
Absolution, selling people absolution is basically a sin tax. William Pitt had a wig. William Pitt was like the Gordon Brown of his day, hundreds of petty taxes to pay for wars. And eventually, you know, he gave his income tax for the first time. But he taxed wigs, or specifically wig powder. So people started using flour instead of wig powder in order to pay the tax. And the unintended consequence of that was that it pushed up the price of flour and thus bread. And there were all sorts of food riots in the late 1790s. But there was a load of people who were conscientious objectors to the Napoleonic War, and they didn't want to fund it, you know, by wearing wigs. So they stopped wearing wigs altogether and wore their hair short. And that this was to signal their objection and also to not have to pay the tax. And the result was that a new fashion started with people wearing their hair short started, and it's never gone away. It became the norm. It was firstly legit, but it started as a mini tax rebellion.
Well, we're on the subject of money. I know Chris is desperate to talk about the Bristol Pound, but very quickly, can you just tell the kind of the story behind the title of the book, Daylight Robbery? Because I think this is something that a lot of people don't know.
So it's a short version. Sorry, once you get me going, I can't stop. It's slightly anecdotal, this one. But the idea is that we had the window tax, and the window tax was introduced in 1690 after the Glorious Revolution, when William of Orange and William and Mary came to power. In order to ingratiate themselves with the newly conquered people, they got rid of hearth taxes, where tax collectors would come into your home and count the number of fireplaces you had, every a bit like TV license inspectors. And it was hated, and it was considered a gross invasion of the Englishman's sacred privacy. And in order to ingratiate the new monarchs with the people, they got rid of hearth taxes. But fairly soon after, the king found himself short of money, so they introduced window tax instead. And in this case, a tax collector just walked past somebody's house and count the number of windows they had, and there was much less engagement with the taxpayer required. Mm. And that tax lasted 170 years. And you talk about unintended consequences with taxation. In the case of the window tax, there were millions of them, but the worst was that it killed people, because homes were built without any windows at all. Bear in mind, there was no electric light or even gas lighting in those days. It was tallow candles, and homes were built, and the poor were hit hardest, because all the tenement buildings, the landlords were liable for the tax. So they built the tenement buildings without windows, or they blocked up the windows, and all the outbreaks of typhus and cholera and all those other diseases that killed so many people in the Industrial Revolution were made far worse by these windowless dwellings, these dark, damp, cramped windowless dwellings. And there were all sorts of scientific surveys were shown that proved that the window tax were making it ill. And still the government persisted with it, and they persisted with it. Charles Dickens called it, "Neither daylight nor air have been free since the imposition of the windows tax." Songs were sung, pamphlets were handed out. And eventually, when debates were held in Parliament, rumour has it that MPs cried out, "Daylight robbery." And that's where we get the expression from the window tax. But as I say, it's only anecdotal, but the government persisted with it. And it was like 170 years after it was introduced in 1862. I think it was somewhere around then that it was finally got rid of.
No, lost it.
Terrible tax.
Incredible. Thanks for that, Dominic. So the book's called Daylight Robbery, How Tax Shaped Our Past and Will Change Our Future, available from Amazon and all good bookshops, I'm sure. So, Chris, I know you wanted to talk about this particular story that you've just written about, which is the question of the Bristol Pound. I've got to admit, I didn't know the Bristol Pound existed, but can you tell us a little bit about it and why it's piqued your interest?
The Bristol Pound is apparently the biggest local currency in the world. And
I don't imagine that's necessarily much of an achievement, is it?
No, they think it's quite impressive. It helped them get some award for being environmental or something.
Oh, okay.
But it's now hit on hard times, as was reported a week or so ago. And since we have a financial expert on the show, I thought I'd mention it. We'll get his opinion of local currencies, because the basic story is there have been a few of these introduced. They're very simple systems. They are glorified gift vouchers, really. You exchange £1 for a Bristol pound or a Stroud pound or an Exeter pound, wherever you are.
It's like money at Disneyland or something, but
yeah,
it's Bristol.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, everyone who's been a child knows your heart sinks when you get given a gift voucher rather than cash, because you can only spend it, obviously, in one place and you want to be able to spend it anywhere. So it's straight away rather limiting, and it's also limiting on where you can use it, because in Bristol they only wanted to have certain Bristol-based organisations. They weren't allowed to be on the stock market, so you couldn't go into like a Tesco Express or anything like that. You had to go see the kind of
Cash. It's not digital.
No, they have made it digital. They moved with the times a bit like that. They've been blaming the rise of the cashless economy for all these currencies going under, but if you dig a bit deeper, it's because the government's been pulling the funding. And that's what interested me about the Bristol Pound, is I don't care if people want to go off and experiment with this really bad economically literate idea. But in Bristol, the government was giving them hundreds of thousands of pounds to do it. And the only people it was benefiting were the people who ran the show, as far as I could see. It was just more jobs for the usual suspects.
Fiat money, government money, is responsible for more ills than anything there is in the world apart from taxation. And if we're to save the world, we have to fix our system of money. And I've done talks at the IEA about why fiat money is evil, and they don't agree with me and they're wrong. But nevertheless, we shall forgive them for this. And, you know, when a government has the power to issue money, it automatically gives government too much control. And once they have that control, think of all the abuses that get perpetrated by governments. Nevertheless, so I am a huge champion of any alternative, whether it's gold or Bitcoin or some cryptocurrency or some local currency. And I have always been a champion of the Totnes pound, the Brixton pound. The guy who organises the Brixton pound gave me a really nice commemorative £5 note, which I put on my wall. And one of my son's reprobate weed smoking mates nicked it, which I'll never forgive him for. But anyway, and the Totnes pound and the Bristol pound, I've always been in principle. And it never occurred to me until I just heard you speak now that all these operations were funded by government. And immediately, as soon as an independent local currency is funded by government, it just becomes crony capitalism. And crony capitalism masquerades as real capitalism, but it isn't. And it's evil, bad, and wrong. So I'm glad.
But even if it wasn't funded by the government.
If it was,
I don't know
if it was
why locally funded, because it's just the pound. It's still normal pound.
Well, yeah, but
you
people
have to exchange it for a pound. It's essentially just the pound sterling, but if there was
some kind of independent local currency that wasn't pegged to the pound and people wanted to use it and they freely traded and exchanged using this currency quite voluntary, I would totally support that because it undermines fiat money.
But that's not what any of these things do. It's based on probably the oldest economic fallacy of all. The first one to be debunked, really, by Adam Smith. The idea is that, you know, you want to keep all your money in the community. You don't want to be giving it away to people in exchange for goods and services, because then you lose money and then you're not as rich. You know, this is the whole principle.
Mercantilism.
It's just kind of local mercantilism. Like, we don't want money leaking out of the local community to those bastards in Gloucester. We want to keep it here in Britain.
Even if we're getting goods and services for it.
Yeah. It's such a stupid idea. It's depressing that anybody.
Well, I'm really quite depressed to hear, because I also, and the worst thing is the people of Bristol or the people of Totnes or wherever it is probably think they're doing a really good thing for their community by using this local money, not realizing that all they're really doing is just subsidizing the issuers of that money.
Every Bristol pound spent in every transaction since it was launched in 2014 has cost at least 33p in administration.
Oh. Well, that breaks another of Adam Smith's cardinal rules. That's just absurd.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So on the subject of absurd stories, let's talk a bit about something else you've written about, Chris, so to plug you once again, is this story that came out of the back of the general election of Tory fake news during the election campaign. So there was this story, many of you will have seen it, I'm sure, that claimed that some independent fact-checking group had found that 88% of Tory Facebook ads during the campaign were misleading, compared with 0% for Labour ads. And I'm sure many other people looked at this and thought, this isn't true. But Chris, you actually went to the trouble of looking into it to demonstrate why it wasn't true. Can you tell us a little bit about this particular story?
Yes, gladly. I mean, this was only, I think, 2 or 3 days before the election. I would argue it actually had some kind of effect, actually, on how people voted. Obviously, it didn't work out the way the Labour Party would have helped. But, I mean, it certainly fed into this narrative that, you know, Boris is a liar, which, you know, people kept banging on about throughout the campaign, that almost everything he says is just a lie. And people get hysterical about the slightest debatable point. And so you had this story, which was very quickly turned into, you know, 88% of Tory ads are lies by various people on Twitter and the Lily Allens of this world. It was a very viral story. It didn't get picked up that much by the newspapers, although a few did cover it, but The Guardian didn't, for example, which was quite surprising. I just thought, this doesn't smell right. You know, if it said like 21% of Labour ads are lies and 88% Tory ones, I might have gone, well, possibly. But the fact that they said zero didn't sound at all plausible. Now, I'm not on Facebook, so I wouldn't have seen any of these adverts. But I did know that the Labour Party campaign was overwhelmingly about how Donald Trump is going to buy the NHS.
Yeah.
And whether you call that a lie or not, I don't quite know. It's a prediction, so it's not falsifiable. But it's like a million to one shot that it would possibly be true. There was no evidence for it. Boris Johnson repeatedly denied it. Any political party that tried it would never get elected again. So it just wasn't going to happen. I would call that basically a lie. I think it's possibly the most dishonest thing any major party has actually said in any election campaign in my lifetime in Britain. And
On the Tory side, I knew that their campaign was overwhelmingly get Brexit done. Now, that's not a lie, and I know there were people saying that, well, it's not going to actually be done and dusted it's on the 31st of January.
Point, yeah.
But they weren't saying it was going to be done by the 31st of January. They said, let's get Brexit done. We're the only party that's going to do it. So I don't think that was a lie. And then there were
good slogan.
Other, yes, great, very effective. Classic Dom. And so anyway, these people, I think they're called First Draft News or something like that. I'd never heard of them before, but it didn't look like it was just like a pop-up, you know, front group or anything. It seemed to be a legit organization. They'd looked at what Full Fact had said about various claims during the election. Full Fact, very good independent fact-checking service. They actually, I think, do work for Facebook to try and judge whether ads are decent, honest, and truthful. But they don't actually say this ad is a lie and this ad is the truth. It's always a bit more nuanced than that. And so I went through over Christmas, rather depressingly, I started looking at the Facebook ad archive to see what these ads were saying. And there were like 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 Tory ones, which sounds an overwhelming number, but actually there are only about 20. They just repeat each ad for different constituencies so they can calibrate how often they get sent out and all this kind of stuff. The Labour also had over the same period, and this is only a 4-day period in December they were looking at, they also had about 20 adverts. They had far fewer duplicates, and most of their duplicates were just adverts saying, here's where to find your local polling station. Now, obviously, if you're going to do an advert about how to find your polling station, you're not going to have any misleading information in it. It wouldn't really work to your advantage. So the majority of the Labour ones were just that, so they couldn't be misleading. And the majority of the Tory ones were either pretty vague messages about, you know, let's get the economy going, and let's get Brexit done in particular. And there were a couple that were contestable. One was the, we're going to build 40 new hospitals promise, which Full Fact had said, well, obviously we can't say this is not true because they might do, but there's only the seed money for six or whatever it might be. And there isn't enough detail here about how they're going to do it, how much it's going to cost. Although in fairness, this was a 10-year policy rather than just in one parliament. So I wouldn't even say that's certainly not a lie. I'm not even sure it's misleading, certainly compared to the Donald Trump's going to buy the NHS story. Anyway, they considered it to be misleading. And there was another one where the government had basically just worked out how much more Labour were going to tax the nation, and they divvied it up amongst households and said each household's going to pay X amount. And Full Fact said, well, that's not quite how it works because they're not going to tax every household equally, blah, 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 which is a fair point. But they were the only two contestable ones. Certainly wasn't 88% of the adverts. So how did they get to this 88% figure? This is the most amazing bit. They didn't just look at whether the ad itself contained any potentially misleading information. They looked at what you could find if you clicked on the ad, and which in the case of most of the Tory adverts, it would take you to essentially the Tory manifesto, which included this claim about 40 new hospitals. And so any Tory ad which linked to a page where if you then clicked on another link, took you to a page about the NHS, the ad was considered a lie, which is just insane. So who's being misleading here, really?
Yeah.
You know, this is incredibly dishonest stuff, I think.
It reminded me as well, because this is slightly interesting, that going into the campaign, you even saw some people, particularly like Labour Party people who didn't want to have the election in the first place, kind of saying, you know, how can we have this campaign either? Because the Russian report hasn't come out and we don't know what kind of interference is going to happen. Not only do you have this story about fake news turning out to be fake news, but the striking thing was probably, aside from, you know, the kind of contestable claims around Donald Trump and around getting Brexit done, and the kind of, you can have an argument about whether or not that's, you know, legitimate to say or whether it's a lie or not. But two of the kind of pure fake news stories, I think, from the campaign were generated more or less by the mainstream media themselves, which is quite interesting, insofar as there was the thing about one of Matt Hancock's advisors allegedly being punched, where he actually just walked into someone's hand, which was something that was briefed out by the Tories and just repeated completely credulously by Laura Koonsberg. And
she got in a lot of trouble with the lefties on that one, didn't she?
As she does most days, it seems like. And then there was this other one about Channel 4 News, you know, mis-subtitling something from Boris Johnson, where he was talking about people of talent coming to the UK, but still immigration being put under democratic control. These are two kind of most unvarnished, it's just nonsense. And then it's gotten around the internet and, you know, in some respects,
yeah, no, that's quite true.
Generated by the supposedly trustworthy mainstream media themselves. So there was so much, it was just, there were so many kind of levels of ridiculousness to that whole debate.
It would be nice to live in a world where people were more honest about lying or bullshitting or making promises. It happens in sales. It just does. You exaggerate.
Yeah.
And elections are basically massive sales pitches. And you know, what election has there ever been in any history where both sides weren't bullshitting in some way? It's just a reality of elections. And it's as though the left are going, it's like they're angry because this side is lying better than us. You know, when Obama used digital data really well, he was considered a genius for doing it. When Trump did it, it was lying and dishonest and everything else. And there's a real inconsistency. But there's a left-wing academic who I saw do a presentation from King's College, and she was really good. Her name escapes me, but forgive me. But she did a whole presentation about fake news and people's reaction to fake news. And the conclusion of the presentation is that people can smell it a mile off. And even with all the bullshit and the misleading stuff that goes on, you know, people see through it, and their ability to grasp what is actually true from what isn't is surprisingly good. So, and that was a left-wing academic, not a right-wing one.
Yeah, encouraging too. Slightly surprising, because I see people get caught up with it all the time. Boomers are always falling for it, aren't they? They have fake news.
Tweets. I mean, initially, like over a day or two they do, but over the broader time period. Mm. By the way, when I did my 17 million fuck offs, I tried to pay to promote the video on Facebook in order to, you know, boost the sales. Facebook wouldn't let me promote it because they said it was political advertising.
Oh, not obscenity. Political advertising.
Well, no, political
but Facebook
advertising.
Allow.
Well, they wouldn't.
Twitter.
I had to
Twitter
do all sorts
supposedly
of.
They're not going to let it. Happen anymore. But Facebook still is, which is why people like Carol Cuddle are so angry, because Facebook are allowing all these lies about 40 new hospitals.
Basically, they don't like it because the power of their pressure groups is reduced by all this stuff, and they don't like it. And they're losing the argument, and they're just throwing anything they can, any shit they can at the whatever in order to try and win the argument. But they're on the wrong side
of the
argument.
The only bit of Russian meddling that's been more or less proven is with the Donald Trump NHS report, right? The thing he waved around that day after he got owned by Andrew Neil, you know, and he suddenly had to rush his stuff up, go nuclear on the NHS privatization nonsense. So waving these documents around, which turned out to have nothing in them, but they came
from... Who was that?
Corbyn.
Okay.
They come from...
Oh, so he was doing it to detract from the fact that he'd been made a fool of that.
These are supposedly like the minutes from the provisional trade talk.
And if you actually
listen,
there was nothing in there, but he got a good few hours of coverage that day. But that stuff had been on Reddit for months, and all the indications are it had been put there by Russians. Seriously.
It's just amazing, though, isn't it? Especially because it's just it seems so clear now that the kind of like elite response to fake news is far worse than the alleged problem of fake news so far. It's just so outsized, so ridiculous. Everything gets dismissed. I saw that at Spike, we did an interview a couple of weeks ago with the editor of Babylon Bee, if you've seen this, which is kind of like a US-based kind of satirical website, kind of more kind of conservative leaning. And more or less as soon as after they launched Snopes, which is a big fact-checking thing out there, labelled them, and it's a satire site, fake news. So they've been kind of completely straight-facedly fact-checking their stories, one of which was about Brett Kavanaugh, quote, submits to a DNA test to prove he's not actually Hitler. And these things are actually being very seriously fact-checked by supposedly intelligent
people. Well, the fact-check is another issue, isn't it? Because, I mean, full facts are really good, and they seem genuine independent. The Channel 4 one is usually pretty good, but they're kind of selective about which issues they look at. The BBC one is often terrible. The BBC reality check one.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. Once you start, I'm now a fact-checker. All right. Well, why should we take you more seriously than anybody else?
I wrote an article for BBC History. And the fact checker from BBC History, whoever it was like so politicized, the fact checking. I mean, so politicized. Mm. And the article I wrote, like the whole point of the Daylight Robbery book, because I'm not, you know, I'm about as libertarian as it gets, but I tried to tell the story objectively. I just wanted people to think about tax and talk about tax. And that was the aim of this article. But it was like he was determined that this article could not be published on the website because it had come from me. And he was like everything he could to no platform. And it was like, give me a break. And a lot of his fact checking was actually wrong. And it's amazing how politicized
fact checking
is.
Who will check the fact
checkers? Yeah, exactly.
Chris, Dominic, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone should buy 17 million fuck offs. Everyone should buy Daylight Robbery. Everyone should buy The Art of Suppression. You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.